We had planned to talk about a little bit about wild bird hunting in the Southeast.
It's tough here in the Southeast to find birds. That's a unicorn, finding coveys of wild birds around here. Hunting for woodcock feels less like an invitation and more like trespassing. I've had gators swim through my decoys and eat ducks in my decoy. I pulled my decoy back, and when I did, a copperhead came out from behind the decoy. I think our bag limits for quail are just ridiculous. I wish it wasn't. Yeah, they're like 12 or 14. From the mountains to the coast to be covered in snow, I don't know that it's ever happened in my lifetime, which is unheard of to have snow twice in the whole state of South Carolina. Big fan of the podcast. It's an honor to talk about the Southeast a little bit.
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm just going to say this right off the bat, Patrick. My setters are just finishing up their dinner, so apologies in advance if you hear any kibble crunching, but hopefully they'll be done soon.
That's great.
Welcome to the show, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a welcoming sound for sure.
You got a bird dog pacing around at your feet there or anything?
I do not. I have a toddler in the room next door. So.
Excellent. How old is the little one?
Yeah, she's two.
Okay.
And then a bird dog probably asleep on his dog bed. So
today I'm excited to be joined by Patrick Hunter. Nice last name, buddy. Was that sort of like foreshadowing your life ahead, or is it just fortunate coincidence?
I mean, everybody in my family, as far back as I can go, was Hunter. So I think the shoe fits.
Let's start there and give you a little bit of background. Tell everybody where you're at and then give us a little bit of your background in sort of hunting and bird dogs and kind of how you found your way into this thing we call pastime.
Yeah, so I live in South Carolina on the coast, just outside of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I grew up just north of like the Charlotte area. So spent my childhood in North Carolina in the foothills, did a lot of things outdoors in the mountains. My dad was our scoutmaster, so did a lot of all the high adventure things you can think of from growing up. And then did a good bit of fishing as a kid and then didn't get into hunting until I got older. But both my grandfathers were bird hunters, had bird dogs. My dad kind of made the shift. He still loves to bird hunt, but he kind of got more into deer hunting than my grandfathers. And so I don't know if it skips a generation. My dad still loves bird hunting, but I'm obsessed. Turkeys, woodcock, and quail. If I get the chance and somebody's got a good field, I'd love to shoot doves. But yeah, I started hunting at, or it was 11, 12, somewhere like that. We had this cool tradition on my dad's side of the family. My dad's dad, so there's 9 grandkids on my dad's side of the family. And my dad's dad gave us all, the boys, a shotgun when we turned 13. And with that, he would take us to South Dakota to go pheasant hunt for 4 days. I think that ruined me. like to go do that and then to come back and quail hunt some, hunt release birds was kind of very different. My upland pursuit is deep-seated, but it's tough. It's tough here in the Southeast to find birds.
From a wild bird perspective, perhaps not on the same, if you're, I mean, pheasant hunter for sure, tough to compete with South Dakota, but the opportunities are
are not quite similar, but that's really cool. It sounds like, yeah, you were definitely going to be given every opportunity to become an outdoorsman, hunter, fisherman, that sort of thing.
And I still do it all. And then I discovered fly fishing in college. And so that's probably deepest diving obsession I have is just catching anything I can on a fly rod, whether it's coast, a pond, you know, warm water rivers we have. It gets me through the seasons of nothing to hunt when it's too hot to get outside and run dogs.
Did you go to South Dakota then right when you were 13?
Yeah, so my birthday's in May, so I turned 13 that May. I think we flew out that following November, so it was shortly thereafter.
Cool. Now, I don't think I missed this, but what kind of shotgun did you get when you were 13?
It was a Beretta automatic, so we were 20-gauge youth gun. Yep, I still have it. It's a great gun.
Like a 391 or something, I guess. I don't know what it would have been back then, but
I think it was a silver mallard.
Awesome. Yeah.
We were spoiled. My brother and I joke about it now because my brother has a six-year-old, and I'm like, we should have started with single-shot 410s. Always having three shells kind of made us not great shots.
Right. I could see that. That's good advice because you probably know this. I know you've listened to the podcast a little bit. I've got a 7 and a 4-year-old, and we're obviously, I mean, one of the great joys of my life over the last handful of years has been just getting them introduced and exposed to the world of hunting and fishing. And I had this conversation a million times at Pheasant Fest last week, which I always enjoy. I love going there every year and seeing familiar faces and talking to new people. And just like my boys are obviously getting maybe an above average level of exposure to the world of hunting and shooting and that sort of thing, but they really seem to take to it. I mean, I don't feel like I'm applying a lot of pressure. And they're very interested. It's all I don't have any single shots. I started with a Remington 870 20 gauge, so not too unlike your first gun. And like you said, my kids, they kind of would have their I'm thinking through like what's going to be their first shotgun, and I've got a couple of prime candidates, but I'm going to be mindful of the semi-auto and the extended magazines.
We all got the same one, me, my brother, and my cousins. And then it was the only one we had. Like, I didn't get a 12 gauge until I was in college. And so duck hunting, quail hunting, dove hunting, turkey hunting, I'm doing it with this pretty nice 20 gauge. And I probably should have taken better care of it, you know, but it was the only gun I had, you know, so it's earned every scratch on it. I'll say that. I mean, it's
a Beretta,
I'll never get
though,
rid of
so I'm
it.
Sure it still works.
Oh yeah. It shoots great. It's so annoying. So I wanted to level up as a bird hunter, and I got a 20 gauge side by side last year.
And, okay.
Trying to figure that out. It's a double trigger. I'm pretty new to figuring out the guns thing. I inherited some when my mom's dad passed away. And so it's been fun to kind of explore and try new things. But it's so annoying because I pick up that 20 gauge and I will outshoot any other gun that I have with that old 20. I was like, why did I ever stop shooting this gun? I never miss.
I think that's where the saying, you know, fear the man with one gun comes from. The one that you're confident with and you've got experience with tends to outperform just about any other one.
Yep. So.
Okay. So you answered my question. I was going to ask you a question when you said that in college you got a 12 gauge. Now last year you bought a 20 gauge bird gun. And I think that's funny. I did a similar thing. My first gun was a 20 gauge. And at some point, I might've been a junior or senior in high school. It was at some point, like, you know, I had my driver's license, a little more independence. And I came to the conclusion at the ripe old age of like 16 or whatever that I'm old enough now. I need a 12 gauge. I need to get me a 12 gauge. And that's what I did. I went up to Gander Mountain with my mom and we bought a Browning BPS Hunter 12 gauge. I loved Browning shotguns when I was a kid. And I still have one. I think I just have one. It's the Torrey Upland Special, which came later, but I bought a 12 gauge and now like I've regressed or evolved depending on which way you look at it. You know, now I shoot 28 gauges and 20s, but it's funny how maybe as young men, we go through that phase where I need a 12 gauge. I think that's pretty common.
We were duck hunting a lot. I do more wood ducks now, but at the time we had access to some family property that we were duck hunting kind of like the coastal marshes. And so we were in that really nasty, brackish, high salinity water and just constantly having to clean those Berettas. So my brother and I were both like, we're going and we're getting like composite stock, just black nickel plated 870 12 gauge pumps that we can use as boat paddles. We're not going to worry about scratching these things up. So I tried to get a 12 gauge Beretta automatic that I shot, and I couldn't. Kind of the same thing, I guess. You're fear of the man with the one gun. I got rid of it, and I've been shooting that 870 all duck season. I started hitting them again. So it's funny how that works.
Nice, nice. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I guess to be fair, there was, when I got that 12 gauge too, there was my buddies and I, we were never really much for duck hunters around here. It's a little different. We didn't have a boat or a dog, so you're kind of limited in the opportunities that you could go after. But I was doing some duck hunting at that time, and that was part of the rationalization for needing a 12 gauge. And then not long after, or at that time, I started taking trips out to North Dakota with my dad. We went out there a handful of years for some serious waterfowl huntings, which, man, that was eye-opening at that time to go out to North Dakota and see all those birds. I have very fond memories of that. So it's kind of fun taking a trip down memory lane with you. How about the 2-year-old now? I think I brought my son on his first grouse hunt when he was 3, and kind of like when I had my first bird dog, I had no idea what I was doing, but I figured, let's give it a shot. I've since learned a lot about taking kids into the field. Are you there yet? Have there been any casual walk-alongs, or are you just kind of thinking about it at this point?
Just thinking about it. She turned 2 in October, so she's still pretty little. But she loves our dog, and she loves dogs in general. So I think it'll be a pretty smooth transition. But I'm going to teach her to fish this summer. That's my goal, to get her on a bluegill. So, but I do have a picture of her. She was like right at a month old, and she was born right before Thanksgiving. And my wife let me go duck hunting the week of Thanksgiving, because in South Carolina, we get that first split the week of Thanksgiving, and then it doesn't come back in until later in December. So I went, I had this great hunt.
60-day season for ducks, right?
Yep, that's right. We get a week at Thanksgiving, and then we go December 15th to January 31st. But my wife let me go out before family came up and saw us and saw the new baby for Thanksgiving, and I shot 2 Drake wood ducks. So there's a picture of me holding her, you know, 1 month old with 2 wood ducks, and I was like, this is pretty sweet.
Yes. Yeah. You might have to text me that picture. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. 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 I mean, she's all bundled up. Like, it's my wife did not grow up in a hunting family. So I think,
okay,
all of this is new to her, but she loves it. She really loves being outdoors. She loves dogs. So it's, it will probably be taking my wife into the field and then taking our daughter. So that's the goal.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, no need to rush it. That's for sure. I started slow. I give myself a little bit of credit. I didn't have too high of expectations, but obviously I've got 2 boys now, and the younger one, Jack, he's tagging along. He's 4, and it's actually been really, really cool to just figure out how to shift gears a little bit, approach it a little differently. You know, there's things to with the dogs and all kinds of considerations about sort of where we go and when we go and what the conditions are like. But I think I've done an okay job of introducing them. And if their level of excitement and enthusiasm is any indicator, then I'd say we're on the right track. Who knows? Will they be obsessed with it? Diehards like myself? I don't know, but they'll at least have a chance to see what it's all about. The 20 gauge that you picked up last year, was a new gun, Orion, Bob White, one of those 2, or something different?
It was a Bob White.
Okay.
Yep. I wanted something more.
I wonder if that's like the number one first side by side for people in the last decade. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think I missed the Orion drop, or maybe I just didn't know that much about it. I'd heard a lot about the Bob Whites, and growing up doing a lot of quail hunting, I was like, man, I got to get my hand on one of these. And I went with the black nickel barrel. I wanted something more utilitarian for hunting woodcock. And it seemed like a good fit. It didn't break the bank. So I'm still new into like getting shotguns. I like old guns. If I could find some old hardware store guns, I think they're just such a unique kind of like head nod to a pastime, but then also really would like one of those upland gun companies like that you talk about a lot, especially in the 28 gauge. So
yeah, well, you wouldn't be the first, and whenever that time comes, you know who to call, right?
Yeah, that's right, call my buddy Nick.
excellent. So it is today, February 25th. Are you done, over with? Are there seasons open? I know, you guys get a little bit of a season extension compared to a guy like me up here in the North Country.
Yeah. So the only thing that's left is quail, and, it doesn't look like I'm going to get out because we got some pretty heavy rain moving in this evening, and that'll kind of finish out the season. So that's a
does
that's
it go
a
to
little
the end of the month, like a couple more days.
Yeah, it'll okay. End at the end of the on the 28th. So, was hoping to try and do that. I have some buddies that work at DNR that kind of had some input on some covers where they were seeing wild birds. I mean, ours are that's a unicorn is finding coveys of wild birds around here, but and then our woodcock season ended January 31st, and unfortunately we didn't get that big snow until the weekend of the 31st, and so there were more woodcock that showed up here in the southeast the first week of February than I think we had all season.
Yeah, it's always interesting talking to people from the south. Like, you kind of never, I mean, I could maybe say the same thing for us up here. You never really know what you're going to get for a woodcock season. Are they going to sort of filter through little by little through the course of the season? Are they all going to come through in one blast? I mean, they can be gone, but you sort of start the season with resident birds. So they're sort of here to begin with. And then it's just a matter of what does the migration look like? Whereas you guys are kind of like, you're sort of like waiting for them to show up, and then they can move and hop around a lot. Like, I've learned that over the years talking to different biologists, and actually I did hunt woodcock one time in Louisiana, and kind of drew the short straw. It was like the week prior they were covered up in birds, and then something happened with the weather or the birds or the conditions, and the woods were just kind of empty. So you kind of never know what you're going to get down there.
This year was weird. I kind of try and follow them in the same way that I follow the ducks, because the seasons overlap. So kind of like we have a really good wood duck season that those first couple weeks of both seasons for duck hunting. And then woodcock, I'd say, are kind of the same way. There's residents, and then there's some that have kind of made their early flights down. We kind of get some migrating wood ducks. And then usually by the first week of January, everything kind of dries up, and we need a weather event to push through to give us, more ducks and more birds, more woodcock. So I think the thing that hurt us the most this year, it was plenty cold. I mean, I think we had record lows in January, but we had no rain. So they were almost impossible to find. I mean, you had to be in the thickest, wettest stuff to find them. So covers where I'd put up like 20 birds in a day, we weren't even moving one or two. So it was tough. It was humbling this year, for sure.
What does a wood duck hunt look like down there? Are you like, on coastal waters, brackish waters, or like where are you chasing wood ducks?
I chase them on the rivers, which they're tannic black rivers. You will get flyovers on the coastal marsh, especially if the coastal marsh, abuts some big hardwood blocks or some big pine blocks. But we also have, me and a couple of my buddies have permission to hunt a swamp behind somebody's house. It's really special because it's like it's the most easy hunt. You know, you go in, you maybe get in there an hour before first light, throw a couple of decoys out, you hunt for 30 minutes. Everybody packs up and is at work, you know, by 8:30. So you can't, it's hard to beat. It really is. You can go 3 days a week if you want to.
Are you in like a permanent blind or something?
No, we just walk in and hide behind the trees. It's kind of.
Okay.
It's not what you think of in Arkansas. We don't have any timber that's kind of that high. So it's more kind of standing in like little bunch together cypresses.
Okay.
If we feel like they're coming into an opening, sometimes we'll string a thing of burlap across the front just to block our view. But I've never set up a blind in a boat. I usually like to stand and try to go on public water where there's kind of little islands and you can stand on the islands up against big trees. But just you could honestly hunt the majority of the places that I do. And I have done this out of a canoe. You don't even need a boat as long as you can, you know, if you're up for the paddle, because that's kind of the best way to do it. So
that's where the black lab comes in handy, though, right?
Yeah, except for mine, because he's like 85 pounds and he'll flip me out of a canoe.
Oh, yeah.
That's where the Boykin comes in handy.
There you go.
Yeah. So.
Yeah,
that's awesome. That's a dog I'll have one day in my life. I need a little bit bigger yard, but I'd love a Boykin. They're such a classic South Carolina bird, and I think they go hand in hand with wood duck hunting that way. You know, having them in a canoe or a kayak or a small rowboat. They're a special little dog for sure.
So I know we're in it, and we had planned to talk about a little bit about wild bird hunting in the Southeast. And actually, this is purely coincidence. Obviously, you and I have been working on setting this up for a couple of weeks, and I was talking to you this afternoon. I cracked open, just by chance, the recent issue of the Rough Grouse Society Covers magazine, and like the second article in was written by you. I was like, no way. I had not seen that yet. And the only other time I opened that magazine was, this is a while ago, one of my recent guests, Tim Flanagan, he wrote like the first article. You were the second one. So it might look like I'm just going right down the list of the latest Covers magazine, but that was a freak coincidence. But I enjoyed the article, and you did a little sort of roundabout about all of the birds that you chase.
So I'm an engineer. That's my day job. So I don't think engineer and creative writer are kind of two things you would put together. But that's become a passion of mine over the last couple of years. And I met the folks from the Rough Grouse Society at SeaWee in Charleston last year and just kind of connected with them. And then they connected me with Brittany Booth, who's the editor, and was able to get that piece in. So I've done a couple articles on Project Upland's website as well. But I'm still very new. So I'm taking every opportunity I can get to get experience and then also get a little exposure. But I'm just having fun with it, really. And that was kind of my that was a fun story to write because I don't think, even when I started this endeavor of trying to bird hunt in the Southeast, there's just not a lot of information. And I don't think that it's folks keeping secrets. I just think that it's so far out of folks' field view. But then, you know, I know you come down for the St. Hubert's trial in, is that in Patrick or in Henry?
So, I mean, yeah, Shiraz. That's the one. Yeah. And it's, what's Cooper, H. Cooper Black. That's the big trial grounds. Yeah.
So that's, it's funny. H. Cooper Black is a distant cousin of mine on my mom's side of the family. So.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Wow. So you've been there, I'm guessing?
I have been there. I really heard stories from my mom's dad about him. That, again, that bird hunting thing kind of goes way, way, way back on both sides of the family. So I'd love to go to a field trial. I've never been, but it's something I definitely want to experience. And hearing your, I guess it was your recap last year, it had me really, really interested.
That was my big takeaway was, I mean, it was just a cool opportunity to get down to that part of the world. I had been there a year or two prior because we went to Siwi. You know, before we hit record, we were talking about Siwi a little bit. Just a neat part of the country that I had not spent a little time in. And see, you know, Charleston's one thing, but then to sort of get into like rural South Carolina and go to H. Cooper Black and sort of walk those grounds. And I really, really enjoyed it. It was neat. And did a little driving around with some of the guys there, Grayson and some of the other, I think there was like some biologists and foresters that got to pick their brain a little bit about, because I saw a lot of forestry, timbering and clear cuts. And as the ruffed grouse hunter from the north, that really caught my attention, just kind of was interested in some of the practices and just a really, really neat part of the world. Like a lot of woods, you know, like I hadn't spent a lot of time there. And I made those two trips down there. Once I drove to Siwi through Georgia and then drove down to Shiraz, and like just driving through all the forest down there, it was really, really neat. Like just, you know, similar to home with all the woods, but different in a really cool way.
Yeah, those big pine savannas are pretty breathtaking. And then I like where they butt up to one another, and you got pine savanna with you know, like blackwater hardwoods and cypress trees and stuff like that. It's pretty special. So yeah. So I live probably 45 minutes from Shiraz.
Okay. So that's not too far.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
You probably drove by my house.
maybe. Yeah. It's been a year now, so I don't quite remember the route that I came in, but yeah, I was probably not too far away.
Yeah.
Yeah. How was Siwi this year? Were you just there attending, or were you there? You do like some gear reviews stuff. Like, were you exhibiting for somebody?
I got a media badge this year, which was pretty cool. I never had that before. So I went and tried to talk to some folks, and I'm going to do like a recap blog of Siwi, but it's my favorite event of the year. My wife's been taking me every year since we started dating. My wife grew up in Charleston. So it's like the best Christmas gift for me to get to go. But this year was different. I feel like every year it's been a little different. It's great to see the quail village. I really like that. Rough grouse, American woodcock throws a great kickoff party on Thursday night. And that one was really well attended. The first one was last year, and this year was even bigger. So it's very Charleston. It's set up at a kind of an outdoor store there in Mount Pleasant. They do a big oyster roast. It was great. Got to talk to a lot of folks. But it kind of sounds similar to Pheasant Fest in that it was weird how I don't think that there were as many exhibitors, but there were definitely the most amount of people that I've ever seen. It was packed. I mean, I think it was really nice weather and folks were looking for an excuse to get outside. You know, we just had snow the week before, it seemed. So, which is unheard of to have snow twice in the whole state of South Carolina. Like from the mountains to the coast to be covered in snow is like unheard of. Like I don't know that it's ever happened, and certainly ever happened in my lifetime. And I was talking to my mom and dad, and they don't remember a time that the whole state's been covered in snow. So it's been a long time. But yeah, it was great. I mean, it was a good event. I didn't, there were some folks I wanted to see. Probably my neatest interaction was meeting and talking to Ryan Callahan from the Meat Eater. Yeah. So Backcountry Hunters and Anglers was there. And I've been a big fan of that organization from afar, but I never really knew that they had stuff going on in South Carolina. Cause I mean, we have some public land, but it's nothing like, you know, the other side of the Mississippi. So to hear them kind of talk through their plans and how they're growing chapters are popping up across the state, that was really cool. That was probably my favorite part. Apart from seeing all the dogs and the cool stuff and the cool gear was talking to those guys.
Yeah, that was I was just I did one of the afternoons at Pheasant Fest. We did a panel at Pheasant Fest. I was with Ryan Callahan. I didn't get a chance to talk to him very much. We all kind of just dropped in and did a little panel on bird hunting, and yeah, it was fun. But yeah, it's that time of year, kind of trade show season, and a bunch of folks that I talked to at Pheasant Fest had been at CWE, and I think we as an upland gun company, we'd like to get back down there. We really enjoyed it. It's a long way to go, some logistics and kind of driving down there and putting our display together, which consists of firearms essentially. So we got to coordinate that a little bit. But I think the first year I was there, the RGS and AWS were there. And that might've been the first time they were down there. I remember seeing a bunch of, obviously I know a lot of people in the organization, and they were kind of cruising the show, but it sounds like they've stuck with it and they've been doing more there. Was it last year that they had the bad weather and like they had like some tents blown over and stuff? I don't remember. Or I heard comments about that, but it wasn't the year that I was there.
Maybe it was last year. I know they shot that. They partnered with Project Upland. Rough Grouse American Woodcock partnered with Project Upland, and they shot that great movie really close to where I live, about, you know, kind of doing the cast and blast thing, catching redfish and speckled trout, and then going and chasing woodcock in the low country. And it was a really, really well done film. But I went to the event on Thursday night, and there was like, I think it was the weather, and then there were some AV issues, and they were supposed to premiere the film, and it didn't work out. So then it just like dropped like a month later on YouTube. But the event Thursday night was really well attended. I mean, there was a lot of people there. So I had to rep my new hat for renewing my membership.
I saw a lot of those hats at Pheasant Fest this year.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny. I don't know how many people in the Lowcountry, or maybe even in all of South Carolina, know what the heck a rough grouse is. And then there's maybe a few more that have seen a woodcock, but still don't really know the difference between a woodcock and a snipe. So I think I'm pretty passionate about, you know, getting people in it, but getting people in it for the right reasons, because if you forget about something, you'll lose it. And if people don't know that it's there to protect it, it's going to go away. And I never thought that I would be a woodcock hunter when I moved here. And so discovering that, I'm like, man, I will fight tooth and nail to protect this, just for my wife and my children to be able to see and hear that flush from beneath your feet, you know, walking in this, the way that South Carolina looked 200 years ago is like super special to me. So that's why I've kind of hitched my wagon to those guys.
Yeah. Is woodcock hunting something you did when you were younger, or did that come a little bit later?
No, it came. It's probably been my most recent endeavor. I went to school at Clemson. That's where I went for college. And I kind of heard about some people, just because we're a state school with really strong ties to fish and wildlife and the Department of Natural Resources. I'd heard about people talk about it, but I couldn't tell you what one was. And then it wasn't until I moved here. I mean, I'd listened to a bunch of podcasts. I bought a couple of Reed Bryant's books and kept hearing about them, but they were kind of this elusive, like, I don't know if I'll ever find one kind of a thing. And then when I moved here, I made a good friend with a guy that had a pointer, and he took me, and I'm not going to miss a week. Like, I'm going to try and go every week in the season somehow, some way. It's kind of a neat story. I started doing it, and it definitely breathed new life into me. But then, best of all, I breathed new life into my dog, because I kind of thought bird hunting wasn't really going to work out for him. And then I got him to woodcock hunt, and now, you know, he's like a different dog. So I'm super,
cool.
I'm super thankful. It's pretty, it's very special to me for sure.
Yeah, woodcock and grouse there. They're kind of like that. You know, they're elusive forest birds. They're not real in your face, especially the woodcock. Like, you dang near have to step on one to like get it to flush. So like if you're not looking for it, even more so than the grouse, I mean, you might see a grouse out on a forest road, or you might hear one drumming. You know, they have more, they have a bigger footprint in just like the aura of society, just because of the drumming, like even that. But the woodcock is a very sort of secretive bird. Like you might mistake it for a bat, you know, if you're driving around the forest country at dusk or something. But yeah, they're a neat little bird, and like once you kind of get caught under their spell, they tend to pull you in. I think that it sort of feeds itself, like being that sort of secretive bird that you got to go find.
Yeah, I don't remember if it's in that issue of the Covers magazine or if it's the article I wrote for Project Upland, but I worded it that like hunting for woodcock feels less like an invitation and more like trespassing.
that was in the RGS article, I think. Yeah.
You know, it's such a hostile thing. Like it's unwelcoming. The amount of times that I've had like my arms pinned and my hands like covered in briars, and then the bird flushes and I like physically can't move to get my gun up. You can't do anything but laugh about it, and just how, you know, either the dog gets birdie, or, you know, I hunt with a lab, so he just flushes them. But if you have a pointing dog, you know, they lock down and you kind of walk up and think it's going to get up any second. And then you're almost like, was that a false point? And then like right between your legs, it just goes flying up in the air. It's so neat. And I like that our bag limits are 3. Cause I really only try to get 1 or 2. I think our bag limits for quail are just ridiculous. I wish it wasn't.
Or like, yeah, they're really high. Or something, or
yeah, they're like 12 or 14.
Oh, wow.
I mean, if you shot 12 or 14 birds, that's per person. So if you shot 24 birds on public land, I mean, you just knocked out a whole wild covey, you know, like that, maybe a couple coveys. So yeah, I understand it, because I also, for dog training and for getting folks into bird hunting, and then for, I even do it for work, for the sport of it, I get the need for preserves and getting an opportunity for people to interact with birds and train dogs. But I wish our wild quail were a little more protected, because somebody could wipe them out, no problem at all, with as few cubbies as we have. So
yeah, I guess
you're not going to accidentally flush that. A woodcock. So I feel like those are safe.
Right. yeah, exactly. Yeah. 3. I don't know when they went from the limit on woodcock used to be 5. I don't know how long ago that was. I suppose it's a quick Google search away, but I don't ever remember being that. It might've been before I was even born. I don't know, but 3 feels like the right number, I guess. But I take that from a guy who has tons of public land to hunt that generally has a pretty good healthy population of wild birds. So, but yeah, it's interesting maybe a little bit that the limit for quail wouldn't be changed. I don't know if that's like tradition. It sounds like you'd have a hard time getting a limit, but I don't know why they would maintain such a high bag limit. If the birds aren't there to support it.
I think it's cause they treat them one in the same. So whether you're releasing birds, or you're, you know, shooting wild birds, the limit's the same.
I suppose because quail are, you can raise and release quail, and maybe there's some overlap areas where like it'd be hard to discern wild versus pen raised or something. Yeah, I guess I didn't think about that.
That's kind of the one thing, if I, you know, whatever, like that would be my hill to die on if I ever to try and take something up with the state would be that, and then to protect our river run striped bass and black bass. Those are my two fights. That's all the fight I got in me. I feel like we're in a good position with turkeys. We haven't been in the past. We're in a great position now, so I feel good about that. But yeah, those are little passion projects for sure.
So talk to me about some of the other opportunities. There were dove, snipe, rails, I think even came up in that article. Talk me through some of those.
I think every kid that grows up hunting, especially if you like, you know, grew up in a hometown that your parents were from, or certainly if your grandparents were from, probably got invited to go to a dove hunt. You know, in the South, a lot of our gatherings are around food. So it seems like there's a lot of Labor Day dove hunts that end in like a big lunch or something like that. So I've been fortunate enough to go on a lot of dove hunts. Those are really fun. They're brutally hot. So, you know, because it's Labor Day.
September, okay, Labor Day.
Yeah, Labor Day weekend is when the season comes in. So, which it's funny, where I live, deer season actually comes in 2 weeks before. If you can imagine that. Yeah, you can hunt deer in August.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of mosquito swatting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, the mosquitoes are about the size of the doves, too. So. but no, dove hunting, it feels like a kind of a cherished pastime. Like, if you get the opportunity to go on the dove hunt in the South, you're going to see 2, 3, maybe even 4 generations of folks out there, which is really cool. It doesn't really matter where, in the South, certainly in South Carolina or North Carolina, where I grew up. And then Martians is, that's kind of a whole nother thing. I've done it a couple times now. There's some friends of mine that put on a tournament in Charleston. So I hunted and participated in that tournament, and it's a true cast and blast. So, you know, it's all around the full moon and the king tide. So you go in there when the tide is up and the birds can't get into the marsh grass because the water comes up, and you kind of flush them with your skiff or with your push pole, and then you do the wing shooting, and then as the tide starts to drop, you make a switch and go try and find redfish, and we were chasing them on fly. So it's really fun to be able to do, you know, kind of two really, really fun sporting things at once. But it's they're not that miraculous when they flush. They kind of hop flush, you know, like it's definitely more sporty. So it's more of an experience than anything else. But I haven't figured out how to cook them to make them taste good, because they taste terrible. But yeah, they sit in the salt water and eat mud all day. So it's just like, it's so much stronger than a woodcock, because a woodcock has that kind of strong earthy taste, but it still tastes good like a game bird. I've never eaten goose, but I've heard marsh hens taste like worse than a goose. So
if you say marsh hen, you mean snipe, right?
No, I mean like a rail.
That's a rail. Okay, yeah. Okay. I'm glad you cleared that, because at first I thought you said Martians, and I was like, wait, what planet are we talking about?
No.
Marsh hens. Okay,
marsh
rails.
Hens. Yeah.
Yeah. My only exposure to rails is, like, I think back to when I was a kid, like reading the Minnesota State game regulations. Like, I'm always looking up the grouse stuff, and, you know, there'd be ruffed grouse, spruce grouse, woodcock, and then they would, like, rails, coots, snipe, these, like, three birds that, like, I don't know what they are. I've never seen one, but they're in the regulations. I don't know, really know anything about rails.
We call them mud chickens. So that's about they're significantly larger than most game birds we have. I mean, they look like a larger duck. And they have like a really weird beak. They just live in the marsh. That's kind of the easiest way to describe it, is it's a bird that lives in the marsh. They're a marsh hen. So
hence marsh hen. So they're bigger than a woodcock?
Oh, significantly. Yeah. Okay. I mean, they look like a chicken.
The association of rail snipes, coots, I guess. I kind of know what a coot is, but like, yeah, like I don't even, yeah, I'm not, I got to do some research on marsh hens.
I don't know. It's called a sora. Have you ever hunted soras?
I've heard of that, but no, okay. I couldn't say that I have.
So that's the only thing that I'm familiar with that's kind of close to a rail. I mean, they're kind of like coots, but they're a little different because they're not really a duck. Yeah, you have to do some research.
Yeah, I got to pull this up. Okay, all right. Yeah, so I feel like I've seen a photo of this before. Yeah, that's, gosh, there's got to be some, this is obvious probably to anybody that knows, but some genetic crossover. The one I'm looking at has kind of got the tail up like a woodcock, and it has like remnants of the snipe and the woodcock in the bird that I'm looking at. That's interesting.
But they're never, I did some research for that article. To my knowledge, they don't migrate. Now, they may migrate relatively short distances, but they're not like woodcock that go from Nova Scotia to Texas, you know, or down to South Florida. They may go from the Chesapeake to the Outer Banks, or, you know, Maryland to South Carolina. I think they do jumps like that throughout their lifetime, but for the most part, they're just birds that are in the marsh and they live there year round. They have this really funny cackle that sounds like a laugh. That's kind of how you know that they're around. Yeah. I mean, at night, it would freak you out.
Kind of spooky.
Yeah, very spooky. But yeah.
I see like a couple thumbnails here of some YouTube videos of a guy standing on like a flat top marsh boat, and he's got his gun mounted here, and it's pointing generally downward, so that kind of tracks with the way you were describing their flush and everything.
I did a guide article on Project Upland. There's a couple photos in there of them if you want to check that out later. But they're not they're. I've heard of ways to cook them. I'm going to try hard this fall to try to establish a good recipe, but I'm unsuccessful. They're a hard bird to get down.
I was going to say, because, you know, inevitably, I've been doing this podcast for almost 10 years now. Like, at different times, people say things like, you know, this bird tastes bad, or, you know, people say sharp tails taste bad, woodcock tastes bad. And it's always like, you know, you didn't prepare it right. You overcooked it, that sort of thing. But marsh hens, that's a new one. So I'm kind of curious. I may get an email or two, and if anybody has any suggestions for Patrick, I'll pass them along. But usually, anytime somebody says a bird doesn't taste good, it's always met with a little bit of resistance. But it sounds like you've tried and you're open to suggestions.
Yes, I've heard about the only way to eat them for they taste half decent is you have to like deep fry them. So then it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like when you make duck poppers. Is the duck popper good because of the duck or because it's wrapped in bacon and cream cheese?
right. Yeah.
So,
all right. Well, yeah. We'll put that one out to the audience. We'll see if anybody's got a suggestion.
That's right. Yeah. There's probably somebody that's got a killer recipe and I'd love to have it. Then, you know, we have quail, woodcock, yep, and then a good bit of waterfowl. So, and then I'm kind of already there. Certainly when the first week of March hits, I'll be 100% locked in on wild turkeys. That's
going to go there next.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. When did turkeys enter the picture for you?
Turkeys are interesting. My dad never hunted them. My dad killed one when we were maybe in middle school. He went with a guy that turkey hunted, but it wasn't a lot of people that talked about him. And my mom's dad, my grandpa, my papa, he actually started turkey hunting when he got some farmland in the lower part of the state. And he was 70 years old when he killed his first turkey. So, like, his obsession started at year 70, and he hunted until he was early 80s, and then he died when he was like either 84 or 85. So he had a solid run, and he filled all of his tags every year. So he was a great, great hunter. He took me and my brother quail hunting a lot. Didn't really care much for deer, was always kind of a bird guy. And I think he just came obsessed with turkeys. And so his obsession led to opportunity to go, you know, go hang out with grandpa. It lined up with my brother and my spring break. And so we'd go down to their farm and would chase turkeys. And so it's kind of a, it's special. It's super challenging and really, really enjoyable. And spring is my favorite time of year, just with everything turning green and kind of the woods waking back up. And then couple that with turkeys and how interactive they are. And then all the memories of my grandpa is pretty special. So my parents were fortunate enough to inherit the farm, a portion of the farm that I grew up hunting with my grandfather when he passed. So the year after he died, this is the first story I ever wrote about the outdoors and hunting. I wrote a story called The Odyssey of a Turkey Hunter about my brother who, we hunted together with my grandpa or separate with my grandpa from the time that we were like 14 or 15 on. And my brother had never killed a tom. And the year after my grandpa passed, I was fortunate enough to call one in for him on kind of this block of woods that my grandpa used to love to hunt. And he killed a monster bird. I mean, this bird was giant. And it was this real kind of cool. It's very emotional. We're Christians, so it was a very spiritual moment as well. And my grandparents are buried at that farm. So it was really special. It was a really, really special moment. So I'll always hold that one dear. But now it's like, I didn't get one last year, so now I've declared war.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
I'm like, all right, you guys outsmarted me last year. I took my foot off the gas. I'm coming back.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you have to have a couple awesome. Screws loose to really like to chase turkeys in the Southeast because, you're dealing with copperheads and ticks and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Alligators.
Yep.
I had an 8-foot alligator across the road on my way to go to one of my turkey spots.
Oh, boy.
I started hunting off a mountain bike last year. And I'll text you the picture when we get done. But I was driving down a forest road, like one of our logging roads that kind of has a deep ditch on either side. And I saw this kind of like black, like, you know, shape like this across the road. And I was like, what the heck is that? And I pulled my binos up and I look, and I couldn't see because like I was kind of on the backside of a hill. So my field of view. So I got within about 30 yards and it was like an 8 or 9 footer. And I was like, holy smokes. Like, that's exactly what I need, to be riding by, you know, on my mountain bike and just get yanked off this thing by an 8-foot alligator. But she kind of gave her space and she moved out of the way after a while. But we had a staring contest for about 15 minutes. I was definitely in her territory, I will say, but I could hear the birds gobbling behind her. I was like, I gotta go back there.
I gotta get back there.
Not surprisingly,
my experience with gators is about nil. So is it kind of like you don't bother them, they don't bother you? I mean, what level of caution do you need to exercise, or is it more likely you stumble on one, surprise one? Is that like how it could go bad, or I have no idea.
It's highly unlikely that it's going to go bad. It's very unfortunate. It's never happened to me, but it has happened to family members of mine. It goes bad a lot with dogs.
That's the one thing that comes to mind, specifically the Louisiana woodcock hunters I was with that came up a lot.
Yeah. Like even, you know, sometimes we duck hunt, and it's warmer and they're not fully in hibernation and, casting a dog out to go get a duck. I've had gators swim through my decoys and eat ducks in my decoys.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Wow.
but they're definitely a lot more afraid of you than you are of them. It's not like a grizzly bear or anything like that that's just going to charge you. I've never experienced that, but spring is tough because it's their mating season. And so they are more aggressive. This was probably 3 years ago. I was hunting this farm and I decided I was going to get in there really, really, really dark early in the morning because I think turkeys, my rule of thumb is turkeys roost over water, especially in the low country. So you want to find any kind of like marshiness and they'll be there. That's usually where your biggest hardwoods are. That's good roosting trees. They can hear and see everything in there. They feel safe. That's where they are. So I went in there and I heard some goblin birds. And then I just heard this like scream, roar, god awful sound at like 7 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't know, because we have wild hogs too. So I didn't know if it was like wild hogs or if it was I've never seen one, but I've heard that we do have some cougars or like a big black bear. I had no idea what it was. And it was a gator like doing its bellowing in the water on the edge of the swamp, trying to either a female attracting a male or a male attracting a female. And it was the scariest sound I've ever heard. I mean, we're not Florida, where they're like in the parking lot. I've never experienced that, but it's their neck of the woods. We have a cabin there and you'll see them. It's cabin's kind of on the river and, you'll see them on trees and you'll see them. I spent my summers fishing there with my grandparents and there's a lot of times where you'd kind of go over and you'd see one sitting on the bottom and you just kind of keep on going and leave them alone. But, the snakes will come after you. I don't think an alligator is going to come after you.
Yeah, the snakes, that's one where, one wrong step kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I'd like set some decoys down. This is 2 years ago, or last year. Set some decoys down and tried to move on a bird. Didn't work out, so I was coming back to retrieve my stuff, and I pulled my decoy back. And when I did, a copperhead, kind of came out from behind the decoy, and the copperheads usually aren't that bad. They kind of are moving on out, but I always get freaked out that I'm going to have a big rattlesnake, kind of want to cozy up to me one of those colder mornings.
Right. But, yeah. You're sitting by a log or something. Yeah, I mean, right, yeah, that could get dicey.
My wife reminds me that I'm not, I'm not a single dude anymore and I need to be a little more careful, but I love sitting in the, kind of the scoop out of a tupelo, especially in the swamp and kind of getting really, really small and finding a turkey. But there's other critters that like those tupelo.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So I gotta watch out this spring. But Noah, I've never been bit. I've never been bit. So
that's good. Knock on wood.
Knock on wood for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like you, I've definitely come to appreciate spring turkey hunting up here. I am extremely excited. That's one thing that like our dinner conversations are me and my boys talking about turkey hunting at this point. And we're very excited. All you can see behind me, it was feeling very spring like before Pheasant Fest, and then
is that snow?
Last week, that's snow. Yeah. We got which is totally normal for this time of year in Duluth, but we were getting pretty low on snow, and we had a couple weekends ago where it was 40s and sunny. I mean, man, it was for a Minnesotan, it was t-shirt weather. Like it was amazing. And our snowpack was getting pretty low, but then we got the northern part of the state. Duluth was kind of the southern end of it. We were overdue for a legitimate winter storm, and we got one. I think we got 18 plus inches of snow here in like 24, 48 hours. And if I wasn't having to travel the next day, it ended up all working out. I was doing I'm trying to pack up, leave for Pheasant Fest. I wake up, our power's out. It was really bad wind and it was kind of heavy snow. So there was a lot of trees down and a lot of people lost power. My power's out. I had all these plans like getting ready, and I spent half the day like shoveling and snow blowing. And that whole day, it never stopped snowing that whole day. Was going to leave the next day. I woke up the next day, had to shovel and snow blow everything again. And again, outside of travel, it was a beautiful, I mean, just like, when like the snow starts to melt, I guess you might not be as familiar, but when it snows, you get fresh white snow, everything kind of looks pure and clean. Then as it melts, like everything starts to look dirty and grimy, and it definitely like that. So it was like a total it was just a beautiful winter day. But it was a lot of extra work, but I did get it all done before Pheasant Fest. So we've got some warmer temps on the horizon and starting to feel like spring is around the corner. But in this part of the world, we could definitely get more winter weather. And right now the birds are in good shape. The grouse need the snow. And
okay. So when does your turkey season start?
So it starts mid-April. Mid-April is kind of when seasons open up. And I would say, like, southern portions of Minnesota and Wisconsin, that's maybe like prime time. If the weather cooperates here, maybe. But the way our season works, at least in Minnesota, it's elective, where you get to choose the week that you want to hunt. And realistically, I'm probably not hunting until May, first week of May, second week of May. But we can be good. Like, I've shot birds all the way to the end of May. And depending on how things go, like, the woods, they're starting to get pretty green by the end of the season, but it's a long ways off. You know, you guys will be well past like green up and primetime turkey hunting. So I get to, unlike the woodcock season where, you know, I get to have my fun first and you're patiently waiting. The turkey season is the reverse for me, but that's all right.
You only have a week long season?
Only a week long. Minnesota, you get to choose a week. I hunt Minnesota and Wisconsin typically, although at Wisconsin, I'm a non-resident and their system's older. I have a family cabin in Wisconsin. And I, as of now, like I only draw a tag over there about once every 3 years, kind of seems like, which is kind of a bummer because I love to hunt every year. But there I can buy over-the-counter tags in different zones and areas and stuff. But Minnesota, you get one bird. And you can choose the week from like April 15th to the end of May. And then if you don't get your bird during that elective week, you can hunt like the last 10 days of the season or something. So up to 3 weeks of hunting unless you get your bird. So that's one of the other reasons I'm pretty excited about my sons getting closer and closer to being able to hunt, just because I'm looking for more opportunity. Like I'm getting, you know, but I could go out in one day, kill my bird, and I'm done for the year. So I'm trying to like tag along with friends if I can, do a little bit of traveling. Like if I, between Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, I could sort of put together a couple hunts a year. So as I don't really do a whole lot else in the spring. Like I'm not, I used to do a lot more fishing and my boys are into that too. So maybe I'll do some more of it, but turkey has filled a void for me in the spring, if that makes sense. Like it really has given me something to look forward to this time of year. So it's a lot of fun.
You're making me very grateful for my, I got mad when they moved our season from, it used to go from mid-March to the first week of May. And they've been chipping it back. And so now it's just a 30-day season, April, you know, April 1st to the end of April.
Like the month of April.
Yeah, okay. Just the month of April. And but you're making me very grateful because I got really mad with it. Right. But now, you know, now hearing that you're at 1 week, I'm like, oh man, I need to be thankful.
Yeah. Yeah. And you guys, I'm guessing you could shoot multiple birds.
We can only shoot two. That started last year.
Okay.
It's funny, when I started hunting with my grandpa, I think this was crazy, but you had a 5-bird season limit, which just felt ridiculous. And then they went to 3, and it was 3 for a while. And then last year before, it went to 2. So that feels good. I mean, I love to eat them. So it definitely, we never wasted any of them, but 5 was probably a little excessive.
No, but like you said, it's a real, I mean, I love to be in the woods, no matter what time of year it is, whether it's the middle of winter. I mean, summer is like the one time of year where it's like, I don't need to be in the middle of the woods. But spring, fall, winter, I mean, give me a reason to get out in the woods. I'm happy to be out there. And so the spring turkey hunting thing is awesome. I love something about a spring morning too. I mean, the birds are going and like the woods wake up and it's awesome. It's a ton of fun. So
I'm at the point now where like I want to get my bird as quick as I can. But if I can open up opportunities for me to call, for somebody who's never gotten a bird, or, you know, maybe somebody who's only gotten one or two birds or is really new to it. That's the fun, you know, kind of the, it's kind of like all of our pursuits. I mean, that's why I like fly fishing, is the catch and release aspect of it is like you get all the way through, but then you can let the bird, you know, the fish go. I almost wish sometimes we could let the birds go, because they're so special. If even if I couldn't shoot them, I'd probably still go out and try and fool a turkey into coming within 10 to 15 yards of me and watch them do their thing, and then, you know, let them go. But
it is cool. I'm in the same boat where I'm like trying to nudge like some of my old buddy, and turkeys are pretty new for us here. You know, they've migrating north, like relocating a little bit. Like, it just was not a thing this far north in Minnesota. Not that recent past, but now I'm like trying to like nudge my buddies, like, get a tag, you know, I'll take you. I'll call and I'll do that stuff. And, obviously my boys will be a good opportunity to get other people out there, but it sets up really well, like if you and a friend to go out and like you said before, it's so, when you get the right bird on the right day, like it's so interactive and fun, like you don't need to be behind the trigger to enjoy it, that's for sure.
I think it's kind of fun to sit there, especially if you're kind of behind, you kind of look over and get to watch the person, like on there that morning I was telling you about when my brother finally got his turkey, like I could just, like, all of his eyes, I could see all the white in his eyes, and I could, it was funny. He started breathing so heavy and his heart started beating like audibly. And I was having to like spit and drum and kind of cut to make
cover up
over top of my brother, because he was just like, so excited. So it was awesome. It was awesome. I got a buddy, a friend of mine that moved to Tennessee about 4 years ago that is coming down to hunt with me and my brother and my dad for our opening weekend trip. So he's chased birds a lot with me on this farm. And so I'm hoping to get him one this year. So I'm excited.
Do you do like all your hunting on the farm, or do you do any public land stuff, or just
the only thing I don't public land hunt for is deer. The public land all around where I went to school, was bow only, and I kind of thought that that's how all public land was, and it just freaks me out being in there, guys with rifles. I will get out if there was a bow area, I'll deer hunt, but for the most part it's just birds and small game, and then turkeys I will turkey hunt a lot on public land, so I do a mix. But yeah, we just don't have a ton of it. That's the thing that's tough is, you know, we've got 200-something thousand acres in the Francis Marion there, kind of between Columbia and Charleston, outside of Charleston. That's kind of our really, really big track. But most of our tracks are pretty small, you know, less than 10,000 acres, kind of sprinkled around the state. So, A lot of times you got to know somebody, either has turkeys and wants to do it. I feel like I get a lot of invitations that way, as guys that want to shoot a turkey but don't know anything about it. I like those opportunities, yeah, where I can, yeah, just be the guy that calls. yeah. But yeah, it's fun. I mean, a lot of my buddies hunt. I think that's just kind of a thing in the South, but to teach some of them something new, like taking a couple buddies here and taught them how to hunt woodcock. And one of my good buddies has Brittany's, and he always, you know, trained them on release birds. And so he's gotten his on woodcock, and he and his family just bought a farm last year, and he was able to shoot two woodcock on his new farm over his Brittany's, which is pretty cool. You know, 2 years ago, he didn't even know what a woodcock was. So that's the fun in it, is just like sharing it with others. Cause sometimes I wish I was the only one out there. but I do enjoy
when you're when it. You're out there doing it. Yeah, it is nice to sort of think you're the only one, but under a different light. Yeah, it's good to have other people out there that appreciate it too, for all the reasons you stated before. Yeah, actually, speaking of turkeys, I started putting the podcast on YouTube like within the last year, and there's oftentimes like there's deer back there a lot. It's like a little bench. It's kind of like a little finger ridge that comes off a big ridge that's out this way. And the deer bed back there, I've had some really nice bucks back there this winter. In fact, just before you and I were recording, there was a buck that had already dropped his antlers. He was bedded out there. I got a little snowshoe trail going out back. So the deer are back there every day, including some like really, really nice bucks that come through in the fall and winter. And I've been wondering, like, as the turkeys, because like, you know how turkeys are like deer where they can kind of totally urbanize, like they can be in like urban settings. And I'm like wondering if and or when that will happen in Duluth, because they're sort of all around Duluth to the north, like every direction, really. I haven't seen a lot in town, but I will say with about a month ago, I saw a turkey out back there when I was just hanging out in my office one day. That was the first time I'd ever seen it. I've heard they're not that far away, so it's not like this isn't like a miracle or anything. I'm wondering if like if someday maybe there'll be a tom like gobbling back there on that little bench. And I don't think that would be pretty cool, but maybe people that live with turkeys, I don't know, maybe he'll be waking me up, be like an alarm clock. I don't know.
That's a welcomed alarm clock.
I would think so. Yeah, at least my blood for a little pumping. While.
My brother sent me a video, it was probably 2 years ago. You're talking about turkeys being in urban settings. He works for an environmental company and their truck warehouse is kind of like adjacent to a couple ag fields. It's like just outside of town. And he sent me a picture of a tom that was just like beating its head against their storefront, trying to get in. And he's like strutting super mad. And they have the whatever is the one-way screening on the glass.
So right. Like, he saw its like, reflection or whatever.
Yeah. So yeah. It saw its reflection. Yeah. It is just ticked, like just slamming its head against the glass. I think it scared their front desk lady half to death.
It's a pretty big bird, you know.
Yeah, a beautiful bird, but just like super ticked off. Like, yeah, I get excited. I haven't seen many driving around, but it'll probably be next week or week after they'll kind of start showing up in the big winter flocks, making themselves seen. And, you know, we'll just wait for stuff to start blooming. It'll be time to go after them for sure.
Yep, right around the corner, buddy.
That's right.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to join us on the podcast. This has been a blast. Do you got a blog or like a website or anywhere that people could go to see your writing? Obviously, we've got the Covers magazine, but
my website is Highway 22 Outdoors. And then you can also find me on Instagram at Highway, but it's HWY 22 Outdoors. I'm trying to do better of pulling together all the stuff that I've written and kind of having it housed one place. So I just got a Substack.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just signed up for Substack. Yep. So I'm trying to put some stuff out there too over the next couple months. But yeah, man, it's been a blast. I've been a big fan of the podcast. Appreciate you. And it's an honor to talk about the Southeast a little bit. So I wish you a good turkey season and we'll stay in touch for sure.
Right back at you, my friend. Best of luck on your hunts. And we'll drop links in the show notes to where people can find you. And yeah, thanks again for taking the time. Hang out with me for just a second, buddy. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Catch you on the next episode, everybody. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.